seven, eight. Everybody's got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before this campaign...
Welcome to Forward Together, a podcast from the Arkansas Poor People's Campaign, where we shine a light on the people and ideas that drive the movement to end the evils of systemic racism, poverty, militarism, ecological devastation, and false moral narratives of religious nationalism. In episode 12, Nate sits down with Arkansas Poor People's Campaign coordinating committee member David Murray in a rangy conversation as David reflects on growing up poor in northern Illinois, on his migration to Arkansas, and ultimately to his involvement in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Listen in as David shares his experience of growing up in poverty in a northern Illinois community devastated by the abandonment of a coal mine corporation that controlled the area. David speaks on the lessons and values that were instilled in him from his childhood as he observed the members of his neighborhood and wider community, gleaning from their wisdom and behavior. These values were revived in his adult life when he left the life of a drug dealer to pursue a more sustainable livelihood. David explains the stark differences in how law enforcement interacted with his rich clientele compared to the poor folks around him. Nate and David discuss the value of unions and the need for new formations of people to unify and work together for a better present and future. David articulates the role fear and scarcity play in the suppression and discouragement of poor people by the powerful. This final episode of season one concludes with a call to unite, cast off fear, and do good for one another and the least of these among us.
David, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Nate. Thanks for inviting me. This is going to be quite an adventure for both of us, I suspect.
Yeah, I agree. I appreciate you coming on. And when we start off, the first question I usually ask every person on the podcast is to kind of tell us about yourself. I mean, you can go back as far as you want, or you can keep it as recent as you want, but just kind of let the audience know a little bit more about who you are and what makes you who you are today.
Well, I'm David Murray. I was born and raised up in northern Illinois. Lived there till I was about 20. Moved to Arkansas there. My family is Irish, Scotch-Irish, mostly. We got off the boat about 1830 or so, went straight into the coal mines. My family's worked in the coal mines until my father's generation, he decided he wasn't going to do it anymore. My grandfather and all of his brothers and everybody else is stricken with black lung, and my father wasn't going to die that way. I was raised in a multicultural neighborhood. Most everybody I knew growing up worked in a factory of some form or another. My nephew is the first of our branch of American Murrays that graduated from college. Dirt poor. That's how I started out. I'm quite a bit different today. Thank you, Jesus. And a certain amount of Irish stick-to-itness, you know, defiance. Pretty much me, Nate.
Well, that's really interesting, being that you're born in northern Illinois and experience the generational work of a family that were all coal miners. And that really is a slice of Americana that is a dying aspect at this point in history. You mentioned that your father decided to break off from that. Did you ever know why he decided to break away, and what direction did he end up going himself?
The coal mine caught fire and most everybody had to quit, and everybody got laid off and thrown out of their homes. And when the coal mine owns all the property and owns all the homes and it shuts down, folks got to scramble and figure out another way. So I think it was to my father and his brother's advantage that happened, though it sure threw a hard scrabble on everybody else around us.
Yeah, it's amazing that story that you just mentioned about how, you know, these coal mines, these other oil and gas fossil fuel companies that kind of owned so much land and property and kind of pretty much owned the labor force of regions of the country. Very perilous situation to be in as a family, as a community, having to rely upon that kind of institution, that corporate institution. So, like you said, the fire came, the coal mine shut down, and everybody had to scramble. What was that like for? Were you around then, or is that did you experience that yourself?
Well, the mine shut down about 62, and in 1962. So in 62, my dad was 23 or 4 years old, 25 years old, something like that. And I mean, it was everyone moved to the factories. He was he worked in a brick factory, made brick during the day, and worked in a gas station at night. Working in a coal mine, you made pretty good money. But working in a gas station and in a brickyard making brick, you don't make much money. So everybody I knew, every adult male I knew when I was growing up had two jobs. And most women, once they were able to get their kids in school, they went and took factory jobs too. I have a brother and two sisters. And when my youngest sister turned 6, my mother took a job in a glass factory, Owens, Illinois Glass, and made bottles, working on her feet, standing on her feet all day long in a hot, hot glass factory. So, but that was, everybody did that. I mean, that's just the way it was. It wasn't the fact that it was a hardship, it was life. And you lived it, you struggled, you went on. That's just how it is.
One thing you also talked about is that you grew up in a multicultural neighborhood. Can you kind of dive into that a little more, what that meant?
Most of the people that worked in coal mines were Irish or Eastern European, Slovaks, Polaks, Hungarians, Blacks, very few Mexicans. Here again, it was poor people who had to scramble. That's just, it didn't matter. They were, what their nationalities were or what their cultural background was, they were all people of the coal mine. That was the one thing that bound us all together.
Thinking about that, just that time in American history, you know, 1940s, 50s, 60s, communities that were developed like that around something like coal mining or even other places where it was around automotive industry or whatever, or the steel industry, all these things that were kind of thriving or important institutions within the American workforce experience, you know, and how those things have obviously over time have all been kind of decimated and gutted out, and it leaves people, like you said, scrambling. I find it fascinating that you're talking about how you have a community of people who are all different cultural backgrounds, racial backgrounds, all kind of having to deal with the same thing. Did you ever notice a difference in how some were able to work their way out of that hard time of losing the coal mine more than others? Was there any kind of systemic issues that you saw that kind of contributed to all that?
Well, like I said, the coal mines owned the properties and they owned the homes. So a person really had nothing of their own other than what they could carry from one old house to another.
Yeah.
And when the coal mine shut down and the properties were being sold off and everything, and it was just a usurious aspect. Coal mines scrambling to get their money out as quickly as they could too. You got a lot of folks looking for another way to go. We had nothing. They had nothing. And it was a matter of struggling to get something. And we found out that the more you helped each other, the easier it was to get something. That if we relied on the generosity of poor people would take care of us. If we depended on the generosity of wealthy people, we got kicked out of our homes and our properties were sold. So I grew up and my friends and things, we grew up to depend on one another because that's all we had. You know, when your clothes is in a box and you're sleeping on your neighbor's porch, you got to depend on your friends. and you got to do things to keep your friends. And that means you give yourself because you're going to need them. And they give themselves because they're going to need you. It's the interdependency, I think, that I've kept through my life that helps me to appreciate the next person that comes along, whatever their situation is, whatever their own aspect in life is. That person is going to need me. I know that. And somewhere along the line, they're going to be a friend when I need them. So, I mean, this big thing about, you know, we're paying it forward. Back in the day, it was just taking care of each other. There wasn't no paying forward. You just took care of each other. You know, some folks took advantage of it, some didn't. But it didn't matter. We all going to need each other.
The characterization of poor people, and especially the characterization of the working poor, there's always this idea that you know, they're lazy, make bad decisions, selfish, and looking for ways to take advantage of the systems and exploit others. Ironically, poor people are exploiting other people in these false narratives. So can you speak to some of that kind of from your experience, obviously growing up in that? Can you give some counterbalance to some of these false narratives about the character of poor people?
Poor people have to depend on each other. There's no choice. We don't have a choice.
Yeah.
My mama used to say when we'd want something, you know, when we want something, she'd say, child, it doesn't hurt you to want. You're not rich. Rich people want something. They got problems. They have problems other than the money they have. So I grew to realize that poor is poor. That's just a place you are at the moment. That if you collected all of the things that you had, all the precious things, you can put them in a box and carry them with you wherever you went. And if you had more stuff than that, maybe you're being a little distracted by other things. Maybe your wealth has taken you in directions that you may not need to go. And that was it. When it was time to go, you had to put your shit in a box. And the more boxes you had, the harder it was to go. So I found that the few precious things are better than a huge amount of other things. Wealth is what you can get into your box. You know, that little box that you can run away with. I had some friends in school that had money and things, and their parents had swimming pools. I always thought that was the coolest thing. But they always had a lot more rules and things. And you had to be afraid when you went into their house, you know, in case you bumped into something or, you know, you tracked something in somewhere. Next thing you know, it's some huge offense. You know, I remember the times when I was a kid and we'd tramp through the house with all my friends. My mother'd be hollering, take off them muddy boots and stuff. But I mean, you weren't tearing nothing up, you know, most everything was washable, you know, or you could throw it out or something. Nothing was so precious. You know, the precious things was having all them damn kids tramping mud through the house. You know, those were the precious things. But damn, I like my rich friend's swimming pools. Oh boy, I dug the hell out of that. That was pretty cool. I kind of envied them when I was a child. I kind of envied folks that had money because they didn't have to think about, you know, what was for dinner. Or, you know, if you're gonna have head cheese again for lunch. You ever eat head cheese? That's where you boil down the head of a hog. You scrape it off. People talk about living high on the hog. Buddy, that wasn't us. We ate head and cheese. That's not high on the hog. You scrape down the head of a hog, you pull as much meat out of that thing and the gelatinous membrane from the skin, and you congealed it, and you added some vegetables you grub up, and then you have it for lunch as a kid. And that's not the most pleasant thing. So I did kind of envy the fact that a lot of them kids came to school with Oscar Mayer bologna. I always thought that was pretty good. When When I was a kid, I thought if you had Oscar Mayer bologna, you was making it. Your family was okay. Not that damn head cheese. Good Lord. But I can make it. I ain't going to starve now. I could get up right now and go in the kitchen. If somebody flopped down a big hog's head in the sink, we could make some up and we'd have it for lunch tomorrow. Just odd things like that. I envied wealth because those kids were going to school with new clothes, you know, and I went to school with somebody else's clothes, you know, but that was the way it was. I mean, it's, you know, I always hoped that I'd never run into somebody that recognized the t-shirt I was wearing, you know, or the boots for that matter. I had a phase when I was, I don't know, seventh or eighth grade, you know, where I was kind of ashamed to have to go to school wearing somebody else's clothes. But, you know, after a while from that, I said, screw them, you know, they won't let me go naked. It's just a matter of doing the best you can with what you got. You know, that I don't know that I envy anyone since young adulthood, I suppose. You got what you got. You make the best of it. You go on. If someone needs help, you lend them a hand. If someone needs a sandwich, well, they're eating head cheese with you. You know? Here again, I don't know if that answered your question, Nate, but I took you on a wild ride there, didn't I?
Yeah. That was great. You're giving us some good insight into the experience of being part of the working poor class, you know, that class of people who have a life that is full of hard work and yet not seeing the fruits of their labor fully manifest in anything materially. On a values level, it seems like knowing kind of what really is important kind of starts to come through. Obviously, you would characterize the community of people that you're with not as lazy or dangerous, but as just hardworking people who took care of each other, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Growing up, the dangerous people were the ones that had money because you didn't know exactly what they were going to do. You know, my culture said, pay attention to those folks around you, and the folks around me were struggling the same way I was, so they were easy to trust. It seemed that the more money that a person had, especially those folks that ran the factories or ran the retail stores and ran the banks especially, you didn't know what the hell they were going to do because the last time they did something, they threw you out of the house. And so you learn from that. You say, to hell with this. I don't trust them. I know right now that some of my old friends, my high school friends, are just absolutely amazed that I'm living indoors at the moment, you know, considering where I started, you know, and where I am now. And I thank you, Lord, that my wife and I are so privileged at the moment. But we remember and we know and we live the hard scrabble life even today. We make sure that we give. There's always someone else that needs something. And God help me, I hope they find me every day. Because that's my job. That's the way I was raised. That's the way all my friends were raised. We were always on the lookout for someone else that we could take care of, you know, to ease the burden on them.
Now, your upbringing, even though it was filled with economic insecurity, housing insecurity, even food insecurity, but all that, or because of all that, even kind of inform, it kind of created a value system within you, as opposed to being a detriment, it ends up being a source of clarity as far as the things that are important and what kind of motivates you even today in your value system.
I think so. I'm grateful for the struggles. I'm grateful for the struggles. I see so many people who have not had the struggle. And honestly, I think I live a better life than they do. I wish everyone had the opportunity to know their inner iron, to know exactly that they can come back up. And all they've got to do is to lean on the next person to them, to let their pride fall, to ask and to reach out their hand, because there's somebody out there who wants to help them. There are. And they've got to trust them. Like I said, we didn't trust bankers too much. We didn't trust too many factory owners. But I tell you what, Miss Smith down the road, who's got 7 kids, who's all wearing leftover clothes from somebody else's damn pitiful Christmas, she's somebody you can depend on, because she knows, and she'll come visit you, and she'll want a cup of coffee with you, and she'll want a cup of sugar, and she'll want to sit and talk to you for a while, just so that she can let loose of whatever she's carrying. But if we reach out, man, if we reach out to one another, we will build up again. That's why we are here. We are here for one another.
That's a really beautiful and powerful message. And I think about my own life, that seems like it's the adversities that have allowed me to expand in my empathy for others and my and humility and softening of my sense of self-righteousness even. All that stuff kind of gets broken down by the struggle of life. And it's one of those things where instead of trying to resist or run away from the adversity, actually leaning into it can reap some fruits of life that and character and perspective that can be a blessing to communities around you as well as your own self. North Illinois, you're born there, and you said around 20 you ended up moving. You came down to Arkansas then, is that correct?
I had made some horrible life decisions back then. It was I was going to engineering school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I found a pretty good way of making some money. And so I decided to start selling marijuana and cocaine to rich, wealthy engineering students and that sort of stuff, and made a lot of money. Decided, you know what? You can make more money selling dope to rich kids than you can drawing pictures of buildings. So I quit school and moved back home, did that for a while. And then I found out that, you know, law enforcement had a way of circling back on you to investigate those things. And so I fled. I fled Arkansas, or fled Illinois, went to Arkansas, thinking I was going to hide out down here. Found out rich kids in Arkansas like marijuana and cocaine too. So, you know, I mean, like I said, you find out what you can do to make the most money you can. And that's, you know, I want to blame it on my heritage, my understanding of my upbringing and things, but hell, it was easy money.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, this is actually quite fascinating, the fact that you're talked about how the financial opportunities that came your way when you started selling marijuana and cocaine to rich people and privileged people, because you know that those are the folks who don't get incarcerated for such things, or the people who are insulated and protected in some ways.
You sold it to rich folks. You did not go to jail because they loved you and they took you into their home. You sold marijuana to poor people.
Yeah.
You were going to jail because they were not going to go to jail themselves. They couldn't afford to. They had families to take care of. Sell it to rich people. That's a marketing strategy. You find a market. Sell what they want when they want it, whatever it is.
And so in Northern Illinois and in Arkansas, you found the same thing. Wealthy people, privileged people who are looking for that recreational activity and for someone to supply it to them. And like you said, they're not too concerned about getting caught up in the carceral system. What's that? What do you think about that as far as being on the end of having to be the one who is find your market and find that place in the drug arena where you're actually selling to rich people and privileged people and seeing that differences for what they experience versus what you experience. Can you speak to that a little more?
Well, if you kept your market to deal with wealthy people, you didn't have police down your neck. If you started selling to poor people or black people, they're being watched all the time. So it just makes sense. I mean, that was the time. That was the day. You know, you didn't sell to black people. You didn't sell to Mexican people. You didn't sell to poor people. You went and found the most upscale bar that you could get into. And you schmoozed around with some drunk. And you talked him into buying a quarter or buying a gram or two just to get started. And next thing you know, you're hanging out in their parties and all that kind of stuff. And you look around and there are no cops anywhere. And if you saw a cop, he was working a deal with you for an ounce. So it worked out great. You know, you stayed in the nice places. I was talking about, you know, hanging out when I was a kid, hanging out with my wealthy friends who had pools and stuff. Well, now I'm in a pool, you know, there's no cops and I'm having a good time and I'm making money. Shit, this is nice, you know, but you had to stay away from poor people because that's where the cops were. My rich friends didn't go to jail. Some of them got busted. They never brought my name up because they knew full well when they got out of jail, I was going to come visit them. That's the process of things. So they were safe, and I was safe. Poor folks don't have that luxury, don't have that cushion. They're going to go to jail. They're going to get thrown in for months, weeks, years, and then they're going to get farmed out to some factory or some hoe squad. That's the process. And it's that way today, you know, now that we have for-profit prisons again, that's not going to change. There's always going to be rich people who's smoking dope. Well, now, I mean, everybody can, you know, and doing their whatever illicit activities they enjoy. And there's always going to be poor people on the end of a hoe chopping somebody's ditch clean until things change, until poor people decide that's not how they want it. And it kind of aggravates me. I remember growing up, everyone I knew was a member of a union. And there was the pride in unions. And there was the power in unions. And people knew full well that even if you were not a member of the auto workers union, you're the clay workers union, that you two could sit down anywhere and talk about what you enjoy about your membership, what you enjoy about having another friend who's struggling with you, whether they're a union member or not, you know, whether they're a member of your union or not. Your union, one body, one people, all making one struggle less hard on everyone. And then the union started getting busted. And then we passed this legislation across this country designed to kill the union. And it's worked today, and it's still there today. If we could change that, we could put unity back in it. We could make one people together again. But it's going to have to take us trusting one another to do that, to know that the person standing next to us is going to bear our weight from time to time. And we're going to bear their weight from time to time. And that's what it's about. And that's what it's for. The definition of union, to join together. It's no longer two people struggling. It's one struggle. It's one struggle.
Yeah, when you're talking about the unions, like you mentioned, what does it mean? You know, the word in the word unions is the word union, which also gives you the word unity, which is this idea of being connected, idea of being together, joined in a common cause and a common purpose, common community. Even when you're describing what it's like growing up in a factory families and neighborhoods, even the coal mines, you know, there's a cohesiveness to that, right? There's a community of unionness to it. And you're right. It's like you see how the division has taken place to replace union with individual, with individualism, you know, where it's about get what you can, as much as you can, and don't care about anybody else. And that's kind of the path you've been on for the last 40 years or so. And it kind of all goes hand in hand, doesn't it? Because now, when you hear the political rhetoric and the debates that are being had, it's often this comes down to cultural warfare, right? Which creates division. And once that division sets in, you know, it can keep us separated from building a coalition, which is the motivation of the Poor People's Campaign, is to build a multicultural, multigenerational coalition of people from all backgrounds that can work towards an agenda that unifies us as opposed to dividing us. But that culture warfare is such a pervasive element of our discourse right now that it's hard to sift through it sometimes, you know?
Absolutely. The whole terminology, it hit me back when it first started coming out, this right to work state. You know, those words sound wonderful. Those words sound, oh, fantastic. Right to work. Holy smokes. That's what I want. But that's not at all what that means. There's a lie in the terminology, and the terminology is created to cause division between people. The right to work. We all have the right to work, but we don't have the right to join together. And that's what that says. Right to work means you don't have the right to join together. And that's wrong. And that's morally wrong. That's not just wrong in industry or in business or socially. When you deny an individual the right to join with another individual in whatever aspect they choose, whether it be business or social or emotional, or if you deny them that right to join, you're breaking their will. You're setting them apart from the strength that they need to continue together.
That concept of togetherness is hard to hold together even today because of the pull of these different elements of our culture that call us to focus on our individual survival. even as you were describing what it was like growing up in a poor neighborhood, you weren't called individualism. You were called to trust one another and rely upon each other. Like I said earlier, leaning on each other to be able to get through whatever situations you're in. So there was actually a cohesion that was being created. And that's threatening. It's threatening to the class struggle that we're dealing with. You know, the people who have the power, the people who have the ability to come into a community and snatch out a business that controls everything and saying, good luck to y'all. That's a lot of power, right? That's a lot of power over a community, over citizens, over individual lives. And so even amidst all that, you're able to experience that cohesion that comes with trying to the common struggle, right? And that's it. There's a common struggle that we're all experiencing here. And yet that common struggle is muddied by cultural rhetoric. Like you said, right to work, or it could be, you know, welfare, or it could be any number of issues. Even race gets weaponized as a cultural wedge point when, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. Like you said, you grew up in a multicultural neighborhoods that everybody was in the struggle together, and you had to rely on people, whether black, white, Irish, Polish, Slav, right?
I think the past 4 years of this previous administration has taught a lot of people, has brought a lot of this to bear on people who have forgotten the unity that we need. And that's probably the only thing that I will give Donald Trump is that by him, many people in this nation's eyes have opened to the power that they have when they unite with another person who's already struggling. And part of that is, and to go further, the insurrection that this nation endured on its capital, January 6th, is the exact proof that poor people need right now to know that if they unite for a good thing, for a positive thing, for a true thing, a thing that builds all people up, they can do it. They can do it. And they will be justified by doing it. Now, you've got 500 people going to prison for those dumbasses that assaulted the Capitol. But there's also a whole lot of people that were watching that said, now's my time to stand up and I'm going to make this thing different. Unite. Unite.
One of those things that were one of the big meta goals of Poor People's Campaign is to bring everybody together, you know, and to go beyond the cultural warfare and the weaponization of identity to really get to the core issues of, you know, what's causing the struggle and the power dynamics that are overwhelmingly disproportionately favoring the wealthy and the most privileged among us. Kind of circling back here, you talked about how you came to Arkansas, you know, you're engaged in selling recreational drugs to rich people. At what point did you decide to give that up and move in a different direction?
All of the people that I knew from that day are either dead or in prison. I learned at a very young age, if you're going to do illegal shit, you do everything you could to hide it. So if you stay out of banking, it's easier to hide things. But that's been a very, very long time ago. 26 years ago, I separated from my first wife, and I had a tremendous revelation then. My friend was married, a fellow that I rode motorcycles with all over the place. He was married to a Presbyterian minister. Debbie had an effect on people. She'd sit and talk with you for a while, and you didn't even know you was talking about God. And there you are holding a conversation about something that you'd been afraid of having a conversation about for a long time. But I decided then, in the fits of this divorce, that my life needed to change dramatically. And I did. And I stopped. And thank you, Jesus, for still being there. I pushed him away so many times, so often, and he was always there, still there today. And I think back about all the money I made. You know, I ain't got a penny of it. I ain't got any of that money. You know, all the money I've got today, I made working, good investments, investing in people mostly. And that's what it was. You know, I had to have a crushing life change in order to see this differently. But but it was kind of revision back to my life when I was a child, you know, all the realizations and understandings from back then. You want good things, you did good things. You know, you want corruption, be corrupt. You know, that's just how shit is. You get what you pay for.
Yeah, life has a way of unfolding before you in a way that kind of can teach you some pretty tough lessons, you know. Well, obviously today you're engaged in the work of the Poor People's Campaign. So what kind of brought you to that point where you're interested in being part of this movement?
This nation has so much. This nation produces enough in a year to feed the world. We waste 60% of what we produce. We waste it. I threw out part of an eggplant frickin' casserole the other day because instead of buying one eggplant like I should have, I said, well, hell, I've got the money. Let's buy two. And I think that's the way our nation sits right now, that there are so many people who, by their own privilege or by their own misunderstood abundance, make too much, take too much, abuse and use too much, that with a little less, if we take in ourselves just a little less, we'll have a little more to give someone else. That's what the Poor People's Campaign is for me, a way to give to the world that which has been so abundantly given to me, a way to maybe touch someone's heart with my story, to where maybe they'll feel the strength to step out and reach out to someone else, either by lending them their own strength or receiving the strength that they have to offer. It's a give and take. A person cannot stand on their own for very long. I say it's better we get ready to receive and to give than to stand on our own. This whole concept of pull you up by your bootstraps, that's bullshit. That is just so much bullshit. It's good to have abundance, and it's good to have boots, and it's good to have bootstraps. But unless you're making them damn boots out of your own hands, and you're killing the cow to get the leather, and you're doing all of that, you're dependent on somebody else to help you do that. Don't be so goddamn arrogant that you've just got to push them aside to somehow or other assume a stature that you have not personally earned. You got there because of someone else. I am here not of my own power, but the power that has been placed in me by God and by those people around me. And I have that power to pass on. I have the responsibility to pass that on. Nothing, believe me, nothing is about me. If we all look at the world as this is about you, if you are successful, then I did well. If you are not hungry, if your children are fed, then I did well. That's how I assess my life. God help me, I continue to think that way.
That's interesting, because that way of thinking is so counter to the narrative of the prevailing American culture of your own prosperity, your own way of thriving, and a bit of a antagonistic posture towards those who we perceive as sucking off the system, you know, and living off of my hard work and my hard-earned income and my tax dollars. And it creates a posture of despising such folks. So how do you counter that narrative? I mean, how do we shift that kind of thinking?
Live it. Let your life be a work of witness. Let those people around you see what you're doing. And if they condemn you for it, well then, fucking great. Condemn me for it. All right. If I'm an asshole for giving a guy on the stand, standing on the corner, $20. All right. Well, fine. I'm an asshole. But that guy who got the $20, he thinks I'm the greatest sumbitch in the world. He thinks I'm the best thing that walked through his life, drove past his corner, whatever. That's the guy. That's the person. That's the one. whose opinion matters. That's the one. We live for the least. If we lived for the least of these, they would learn and understand, and they would see you, and they would mimic you. We're here to provide a positive growth example for one another. Let our work be our witness. Let our work be the truth that we pass on to the world. If the truth we want to pass on is to gouge and kill and make everyone's life miserable, you can do it. And we see it around us all the time. But people are going to remember that too. And if you leave a legacy of any form and they say, well, he was a son of a bitch, but boy, he was rich, then your life is not a positive influence on anyone. If I die a fool for giving to someone else, well, then thank you, Jesus, I've done something right.
Now, you're using some language of the Christian tradition that is really good wisdom as far as thinking about the least of these and thinking about how we can be compelled to the social good of meeting the needs of the least of these. It's interesting that you find that meaningful within the Christian tradition, and yet, there is this whole faction of Christian communities who find it very difficult to identify the undocumented immigrants or the poor people as the least of these. And in fact, they're vehemently against, you know, any kind of social good that goes towards them. Why is it that you can draw from the Christian tradition and see this as something worthy of spending our life energy and meeting the needs of these least of these in this way of social change, social good, as opposed to other groups of Christianity in which they say, no, we don't need the government involved. We just need to, you know, they just need to do everything the right way, you know? Why is there a contrast there? It just really baffles me.
Fearless. I'm fearless, Nate. I think people who want to help other people are fearless. I think a person who is willing to step outside of their own comfortable place is taking a fearless step, and that's what God calls us to do. Be without fear. I think people who are sheltered under their money and their opulence and their own greed or judgment are not going to benefit as fully as those who give abundantly, just as God has given us abundantly. It's fear that keeps people from being more than they could possibly be. It's the fear of not having someone there to help you. It's fear that keeps us from being more for ourselves and for our communities. I say be fearless.
As you're speaking this, I am reminded about what you already, as you described your childhood, your upbringing. You didn't have a lot, and what you did have, you could put in a box and carry it around, almost as if that informed you of the futility of holding on to our possessions too tightly. To me, it kind of, when you say being fearless, it's kind of, I feel like that's been informed by that experience of yours, that, you know, it's like you're not overly concerned about possessions because you know what it's like not to have them, and yet you are still okay. You know, you're still found ways to thrive and found ways to find community and belonging without having a bunch of stuff. And so I just really wanted to connect those dots there and see how that would inform you in the way that you are. And I was also thinking about the idea of ecosystem. You mentioned earlier how, you know, we think that we're individuals, that we can bootstrap our way through life, and yet we don't realize the fact that someone manufactured those bootstraps, somebody raised the cow, someone, you know, there are not only just humans, but also nature itself. You know, the grass had to grow, the cow had to eat the grass, the fact that we as human beings are connected to the very earth itself, that we cannot make it on our own without the earth and without the planet, without nature itself. We are with all that, and yet we can get so wrapped up in our individualism that we forget, even without the bacteria that live inside of our gut being there, we couldn't survive. We would die. So we're not just individuals in any way, and we definitely need each other. Thank you. you think the Poor People's Campaign is a movement for this time, and why are we putting energy into this work?
We will deny ourselves comfort for fear. We will deny our friends comfort for fear. We will deny our children for fear. Now is the time to be fearless. I think in small groups, if we unite, it'll encourage other small groups to unite. One person seeing the effect of two people walking together are going to join that crowd. Five people walking together is going to draw a sixth one. Justice does not come about on its own. It comes out by the fight and the fury of the people who unite. I want justice. I think the world needs justice. In order to get justice, we've got to put fear aside. We've got to depend on one another. We've got to be ready to reach out to them and them to reach out to us. Poor People's Campaign is that step away from fearfulness, away from anger and fraud and all those things that corrupt unity. We have to be fearless. And I think the Poor People's Campaign stands fearless against all who come. It was started in 68 and it's here today. It's fearless. That's another step strongly forward always. And picking up one more to go with us. And picking up one more to go with us. And one more. And one more. That's what we do.
As you're talking about the fearlessness of those involved in the campaign, my mind was flashing to the images of the poor people who have stood up and vocalized, you know, their situations, who have stood and said, you know, we need a change. We need major structural changes, and we need your help. We need a better way forward. And it takes a lot of guts to stand up and voice your opposition to the status quo from a position of being poor. Because like you already talked about, in every situation of life, poor people are the most vulnerable. Like you said, you can go into a rich neighborhood, privileged neighborhood, and you can, you know, have a different experience than you will in a poor neighborhood. And so to stand up and to speak with the, like you said, not alone, but within the unity and the backing and the solidarity of this movement, it gives you the courage to speak up. It's truly inspiring and powerful. So when it comes to the idea of fear, one thing that kept kind of my mind as well is the word scarcity. And when we have a scarcity mindset, that kind of compels us to want to close off our generosity. And I think part of the culture warfare construct that we deal with in this country is trying to fabricate a false sense of scarcity. Like you already talked about, we waste so much, you know?
I think a great deal of it is when you can cause fear, bring fear up between two people, you can set them against one another. And that's the point. You want to break the ranks. You want to break the strength of people. Cause fear. Make them think that they don't have enough and the guy next to them has everything that they deserve, that they should have gotten to begin with. The point right now is division. Divide people. Let them, cause them to look at one another instead of encouraging them to look at the people who have the power right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I am never going to be Bezos. And I could hold you responsible for it. But that'd be wrong. That'd be absolutely wrong. I am me. He is him. You are you. We are here because of circumstances, whether we are exercised in them or not. But here we are. Their point is to divide us from one another because they know that unity is that one power that they can't buy or sell. Right now, we're going through this issue with voters' rights. What'd they say? 43 states put forth 300 voter rights bills this last legislative session. How in the hell could voting be so complicated? It's complicated to divide the electorate. That's the only reason. Because those people who have the money know that if we are one people facing one struggle, that we cannot be defeated. We cannot. All these things can be overcome if we, the people, choose to do it. Everything, every infringement that they have laid on us can be overcome if, in fact, we choose to defeat it. Every one of them. It doesn't matter. And the only way to eliminate the possibility of them continuing these infringements is to defeat them. That's our goal. If you want justice, do justice. If you want to piss and moan, if you want to whine about your troubles in life, well, fine, whine about your troubles in life while we're going down the road to the ballot box. Everything, every infringement that they have faced before us can be defeated if, in fact, we want to unite and do it, but it's going to take one people, one body, more powerful than any other body else. That's what it's going to take. We got to do it.
And it seems like there's a lot of distractors or detractors from in our culture that kind of can distract us from working towards the ultimate goal of unifying as one people, one body, working towards common goals. And like you already mentioned, that's kind of intentional and that's structural that you set up that way, because as long as the status quo stays the way it is, the oligarchs, the rich and powerful, the financial sector, all these major players continue to have and hold the power. You're absolutely right. It's like there's anything they throw at us, you know, if, as long as we have that goal in mind, we can kind of say this is not the end. We don't need to throw up our hands and give up. But Nick, we continue to just double down on our desire to do work, this work together. And that's something that I have to kind of remind myself, is that I'm not in this alone. We're not in this alone. You and I are not alone. Even just you and I talking is encouraging, but yet there's so much more than just us out here doing this work. As long as we keep reminding ourselves that we're part of something bigger, we can keep going, you know? We can take on these different challenges. This work does take energy and focus. So what gives you the energy to keep going?
The children, Nate. There's no reason in the world a child in this nation or in this world should suffer at all. They're going to. Disease is disease. Famine is famine. We've abandoned our earth for so many years. We are in a state right now where we can't buy our way back to goodness, but we have one another. It's the children, Nate. It breaks my heart every time I see a child suffer. And there's no reason for it. And there's no reason for it. I look at this damn COVID, and inside of a year, we came up with 3 vaccines to treat 6 billion people, 7 billion. How many people are in this world now? 7 billion people. We have the capacity to treat all of those people. And it took a year to get that together. Now, it's going to take longer to treat them all, nonetheless. I mean, we're working with logistics and greed here. But in a year, we came up with a virus or with a vaccine, 3 of them at least, to attack. We can do that with anything. We can do it with anything. We've proven it time and time again. Time and time again. Jesus says, if you have ears, listen. If you have ears, you will hear me. And that's what we've forgotten to do. We've forgotten to listen. And we've been hearing it forever. We've heard these same stories that horrible things happen. People come together, they rally their strength, they rally their intellect, they rally their will, and they change things. They make it right and they make it better. In one year, we've produced 3 vaccines to cure this thing, to kill this virus. We could do it with cancer. We could do it with anything. We could do it with everything. We could do it with poverty. As long as we take the profit margin out of it. That's where it is. That's why I am. That's why. Children should not be sick. Children should not suffer. And we have it within our capacity, within our own being at this time. If no other time in history, we have that capacity, but we don't have the will.
You're correct that we definitely have plenty to go around, and there is really no reason why there should be a single child in poverty or having that kind of level of insecurity in our lives, especially in the United States, but even globally, that we have, there is so much wealth going around that is incredible that we could solve it all. So my next question is, do you lean into hope for as an important mindset to have in this kind of work, or do you think hope is kind of a slippery slope of kind of discouraging you from this movement? What do you think about the word hope?
Well, I think you could take everything from a person, and the only thing they'll have left is hope. And I've experienced that all my life. I've been in situations that I've placed myself in and that I've found myself in. Sitting in jail, I had nothing left but hope. They took everything else from me, but I had hope. I think of all of the power an individual is endowed with is hope. And there are times when we all find ourselves in hopeless situations where we reach out and we say, God help us, or Melody help us, or Nate help us. But when we reach out and say, help us, that's hope. At the deepest, darkest depths of our despair, we have hope. And it can't be taken away from us. It cannot be taken away from us. Hope. Hope is there. Hope will always be there. And I think the more that a person is inflicted, the more hopeful they become. I don't think hope can be taken away.
Yeah, it definitely seems like that is a truism of the very essence of a human being. Being able to have that hope that can allow you to endure all kinds of suffering and to keep going. And I like what, this kind of circling back what you talked about before, sometimes you may not be able to find the hope within yourself, but then you can lean on someone else who has the hope for you and draw on their hope.
Absolutely. We've had conversations with other folks, preachers and stuff, about, you know, the whole aspect of congregating. You know, why does a person need to go to church to pray, to read, blah, blah, whatever bullshit is. And my friend, Deborah Henning, the wife of the friend that brought me back to church, she said, the reason to gather is to share the pool of faith and hope. That people walk in there, sometimes they are on a hopeless, faithless journey. They're struggling. They have no earthly idea what to do other than to put one foot in front of the other and find another person. And that person has enough hope and faith for them to carry them for that moment. And that's why we congregate. And that's why we get together. And that's why we unify. Not because I am more faithful than anyone else or I am more hopeful than anyone else. But that little bit of faith and hope that I have may be enough to get the next person through it, to build them up enough to where they can say, I can go on. I can make this too. We can't. We can't be alone. We are not designed to be alone. We are designed to unite. There I go, circling back.
Exactly what I was thinking about. Like you talked about unions and how they created a community and a connection, and that dismantling that system, not only did it impact the labor force, but I think it impacted the very fabric of our American society. You know, it actually ushered in an even more individualistic mindset and a fracturing of community, you know. Because the local union actually played a prominent role in many communities, right? And being a source of gathering together, a reason to get together, a reason to share and talk and and find your commonality in the struggle. And I mean, they're not, obviously unions are not perfect. They got their flaws and they got their issues. But boy, howdy, man! I think we lost something significant. You know that, you know, churches play a role in that today, but not everybody's a church person. You know, and so it's like, what do you have if you don't go to church? What else do you have in this country that can bring you together in a way that's significant and powerful? It used to be the unions. It used to be your labor, your job, and it. What is it now? And so, like, the Poor People's Campaign is, me, even right now, can play that role in that. Like, when we get together for these different events we've had in the past and even coming up here in the future, it is such a source of life for us, right? And a shot in the arm of, hey, I got to see you face to face. We get to find our common ground and where we're headed together. And it's like, yeah, this actually is energizing and fills you with hope. And so I think more and more of these types of movements are popping up, meeting a need in our society where people are looking for some reason to be together, some reason to join together for a common cause, because it feeds our human soul, it feeds our human spirit to be joined together. Well, this has been a really great conversation. And David, I just want to say thank you again for joining me. And I really enjoyed the conversation. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Hey, one more thing, Nate.
Yeah.
Forward together, brother. Not one step
back.
Not
one step back.
Not one step back.
That's right.
We hope that you enjoyed the conversation today. This is the last episode of Season 1, and we are grateful that you have been on this journey with us as we engaged in meaningful conversations about the movement to end the evils of systemic racism, poverty, militarism, ecological devastation, and false moral narratives of religious nationalism. As we contemplate the future of this podcast, we hope that you will continue to listen and share these 12 episodes with family and friends to keep the conversations alive. It has been an honor and pleasure to bring you each chapter of this unfolding story as we work together towards justice for all. We can do this together. Let's go forward together, not one step back. Forward Together is a production of the Arkansas Poor People's Campaign. The host of today's episode was Nate Davis. Producers of the episode include Nate Davis and David Coffey. Script writing by Nate Davis. Intro and outro songs created by the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Instrumentals by David Coffey. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Connect with the Arkansas Poor People's Campaign on Facebook and Instagram at Arkansas Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. On Twitter at Arkansas PPC, or by going to www.poorpeoplescampaign.org/Arkansas. Thank you for listening, and please share this podcast with others.